Hello, and welcome to History in Reverse, a father-daughter science fiction podcast. Today we will be discussing War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. Hello everyone, my name is Caroline and I'm here with my father, Richie.
Hello.
And we're continuing our project to read a science fiction book every month or so and discuss it. And so today we'll be doing War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. This is our fifth book that we've done and it's going to be the final one in our series of weird alien books. Right, Dad? So all the books we've read so far have sort of had strange aliens in them, right? So we're going to discuss this one today, and then I think we're going to do a short podcast for December that summarizes all of them.
Compares different aliens.
Yeah, and compares them across. I could see, like, a lot of themes coming up and a lot of similarities between them. I think it's really interesting. So to jump in, starting off with H.G. Wells and some information about him, you looked up some stuff?
Right, so interesting thing about this book, I think it's kind of appropriate since it's very close to Halloween. Mm-hmm. So, H.G. Wells was an English writer, and the book was published in 1898, which was before, like, World War One and stuff, which is kind of, I was kind of surprised, actually.
And this is the oldest book that we've read, too, so far, yeah.
Yeah. What happened was he grew up, let's see, he was born in 1866, and he grew up kind of poor. His mother was, like, a maid, and his father did this, that the other thing, tried some businesses that didn't work very well. Mm-hmm. And he was apprenticed to some, I forget what it was, but he hated it, basically. So he, at one point in his early in his life, he discovered someone's library, and he started reading like crazy. So he wound up becoming a teacher. Mm-hmm. And then he started writing. His very first novel was Time Machine, which,
yes,
I think everybody's read by now.
Yes, I've read Time
and
Machine.
It was only written like 2 or 3 years before War of the Worlds. And some of the other books he wrote was Invisible Man, The Island of Dr. Moreau. There's a bunch of utopian books that he's read. And he wrote both fiction and nonfiction, so his list of works is quite large. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the basic thing about him. So there's two historical things I want to mention. So one is that War of the Worlds is famous because in, when was it, like 1930-something, Orson Welles, who was a famous actor, at the time he was a famous actor on the radio, mm-hmm, and radio was the kind of big thing, and he did a broadcast, a radio production of the show, of the book, War of the Worlds, which, mm-hmm, you can actually listen to, it's available on YouTube. Mm-hmm. They kind of staged it to sound like a news broadcast. Mm-hmm. So allegedly these aliens came to New Jersey. And there's a sort of story that it caused white panic and stuff, which is not true as it turns out. Mm-hmm. But it makes a good story.
Yeah.
So that's one part of it. The other interesting thing about H.G. Wells' book, I think it's the first novel that had aliens from other planets coming, mm-hmm, to Earth. I mean, clearly there's stories on beings from other worlds and mythology and stuff, mm-hmm, but not in this kind of science fiction.
Not like in an invady kind of way.
Right.
Yeah.
There's something that's kind of very funny, very funny now anyway. It's called the Great Moon Hoax, which happened in 1835. Mm-hmm. What happened was around that time, some scientists built a more powerful telescope, and there was a newspaper in New York called the New York Sun, which, mm-hmm, decided to essentially make up a story that with this powerful telescope, they discovered men on the moon.
Oh.
And they were Batman, you know, but they had wings and they flew and had. So that whole series of articles about this, mm-hmm, they sold a lot of papers. So the idea of like beings living on another planet was around. I mean, this is, mm-hmm, we're talking about 1835, but they never had appeared in a science fiction book like this.
Right, and a lot of the ideas that he comes up with here sort of become like classic kind of science fiction ideas that,
right,
we see repeated elsewhere, and we'll go through those as we go through the story. You were telling me before that in the... So this takes place, the story takes place in England.
Right.
and in the hometown. These are actual places, right?
Right. So he basically essentially describes his life. He's a writer. So he works from his house, and the town is walking, right?
I think so, yeah.
And today, I guess because he lived there, they have a sculpture of like a emotion invading machine.
Yeah, like a tripod, which I think is the cutest thing.
I'll try to
thing.
Remember to add a link to and a show notes so you can take a look at it.
I think that's adorable. Okay, great. So let's jump into the story, I guess, overall. First of all, thinking about the structure, we've dealt with a lot of books that have interesting structures. This is a pretty much first-person point of view, more or less.
Yeah, from two people.
Right. Well, I mean, it's still first-person. So the thing about it is that the narrator is never named. A lot of the characters in the story are not named. And the narrator, you know, lives in England. The story is from his point of view, but he's telling it from some future point in time. So he's sort of looking back and saying, like, I did these things in the past. And because of that, it allows for two things. It allows the narrator to tell other people's stories and experiences. So at one point in time in the middle, he just sort of stops his own story and starts telling the story of what happened with his brother. Because he wants to tell the story of what happens in London, basically. So he tells the story that his brother had ultimately told him about his brother's experience. And it also gives the reader sort of the hint that the narrator survives everything.
Right.
Which is, you know, I think very effective in this kind of story where there's like so much death and destruction and stuff happening. So, I mean, the story's sort of straightforward. It goes chronologically, but I thought maybe reading the first couple lines of the story. Oh, actually, the first paragraph's really long. I didn't realize how long the first paragraph was. I was going to read the whole first paragraph. I'll read the first couple lines or so. I was surprised personally about how good. Have you read this before?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. See, I've never read this one before. I didn't expect the writing to be this good. I don't know why. I don't know if it's because.
Well,
it's like,
I mean, it's this is, you know, 19th century England. People did lots of writing and reading.
Yeah.
And you know, no TV, no internet, that kind of stuff, no radio. So yeah, they had to entertain themselves somehow.
I think, you know what it is. It because it's been so like this idea of like Martians invading Earth. Nowadays seems so like generic almost, like it seems like overdone.
Yeah,
that I like didn't think that the original work was, it didn't like strike me that maybe the original work was like a serious piece of literature, because it felt like a very like overdone in the media kind of thing. But that's because now it's 2018,
right?
No, so I'm just going to read the first couple lines of the book. No one would have believed in the last years of the 19th century that this world was being watched keenly and closely by intelligences greater than man's, and yet as mortal as his own. That as men busied themselves about their various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied, perhaps almost as narrowly as a man with a microscope might scrutinize the transient creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. So, I mean, that's just the first, like, two sentences.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's fabulous. And that actually gets to one of the main themes of the story, overall, which is the sort of he plays on these themes of like the animal kingdom and power structures and stuff, and the, you know, characters later making the comparison between men and ants and the Martians and men.
Right.
So
should we just go through the plot? Just vaguely?
Yeah, let's just start from, yeah. So where does it start?
So it starts, you know, he's hanging out in his office, and there's a meteor that comes.
Right, that they see through a telescope, right?
Well, no, there's been some reports, people observing Mars, that all of a sudden they see like smoke, something happening on the side of Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometime after, there's this meteor with lots of green light kind of coming down. And it turns out it lands close to his hometown.
Mm-hmm.
Was it Horsell Common?
Yeah.
Is the place. So, you know, he finds out about it, and he and a bunch of his friends decide to go and check it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they go and just like a couple of his science-y buddies go to see where the first meteor is, and he's not the one that's there when it opens, right? It's the other scientist, Ogilvy, or
right. Well, I mean, they get there and find there's the cylinder kind of buried because it made a big hole when it hit.
Mm-hmm.
Was it making noises or anything?
It was really hot.
Was hot,
that's
right.
One thing that happens with all the Martian stuff is like super super hot. And temperature is like a big problem throughout the story.
Well, I mean, you would you would expect it to go into the atmosphere like a meteor or burn up.
Right, right. So it made this big hole in the ground, and it was this sort of, it's like a cylinder with like a flat side.
Right.
And it, the flat side's sort of up so that people like stand on it at times and stuff, because it takes it a while for it to do anything. And, you know, everyone thinks initially it's a meteor, it's a rock.
Right.
And then they sort of slowly start to realize that it's hollow on the inside, and then it starts to unscrew.
Right. That's when it kind of starts peeking out.
Yeah. But it's there for like a solid day before it opens.
Yeah.
One of the things I think is interesting about the story is that the way the people react, the way the humans react.
I think it also happened like on Sunday, right? So it's like this is
or life. Was a Friday. There was a, because there's a chapter titled Friday Night or something like that.
Right. So it probably landed like on Friday night, by like Sunday it was a, you know, weekend kind of excursion where people wanted to go check it out.
Yeah,
As a little weekend adventure.
Yeah. So it's sort of interesting because the technology of the time that the humans had sort of limits the way people react. So the narrator, you know, notes that word is traveling about this weird meteor and people are sort of starting to come and see it, and sort of like a vacation almost kind of thing.
Well, this is Victorian England, I guess, you know, late 1900s, so best communication that you have is telegraph,
mm-hmm.
and newspapers,
right?
Right, and trains.
Mm-hmm.
And those are like the main things.
And several of the newspapers in the story start printing information about this weird meteor.
Right. And some of it is a little bit off, and people saying that they don't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
But some people are curious, and you know that's what people would do in those days. Is on weekend go into the country.
Yeah.
And this is kind of like in the suburbs, you know, further suburbs mm-hmm. of London. So.
Yeah. So. It takes it like at least a full day to open.
Yeah, more than that.
Yeah, because the narrator goes and sees it when it's still closed, and then like goes home and tells his wife about it. And
yeah, and they have is it Saturday night they have a dinner or Sunday night they have a nice dinner?
Yeah, whatever that first night is, they have a nice dinner, and then
And one of the things he says is, this is like a nice dinner I'm going to have. Didn't realize that was the nice dinner I was going to have for a very long time.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to be happy.
Exactly. And the writing is fantastic when it comes to sort of this sense of like the calm before the storm. Because mm-hmm. he does that like with the foreshadowing where he sort of is saying, you know, like, we didn't know what it was we were dealing with, but we were going to find out.
Right.
Because it's so interesting, like, he wakes up the next morning, I think, and his neighbor's, like, gardening, and they're talking about this, like, weird meteor, and it's like, we, the reader, know, I mean, maybe now, as the reader in 2018, we know that it's full of meteor, full of aliens. I don't know what the reader at the time would have thought
right.
about it.
So, yeah, again, just a little bit historical perspective, what I've heard when I was reading about H.G. Wells, they said around the time, the kind of invasion of Britain novels were very popular.
Mm.
It's like, you know, the Germans were going to invade and stuff. So it probably feels was like in that genre a little bit.
Yeah, which I think is very effective. But I'll talk about, remind me later, I'll talk about the genre more. So, ultimately the cylinder opens.
Right.
And the Martians come out. And they're kind of like brownish globby things.
Yeah, he doesn't describe them very well then there.
Yeah.
They don't seem to be very happy mm-hmm. about all the people around there.
Yeah.
And they start making things like there's some noise coming mm-hmm. from the pit.
Right.
And somebody gets too close and they use the heat ray.
Yeah. So the heat ray is sort of interesting because this is, we think, the first time a heat ray pops up in science fiction.
As far as I know.
As far as we can identify. And so, I mean, this was an original idea. It's so funny because I was reading and he's describing this, not exactly a beam, because he doesn't really describe, you can't really see it.
You can't see it, right? I mean, you can't see heat,
right? Right.
But you can certainly feel it, right?
Right. So it's just like suddenly everything like in a line would be on fire or be combusting right. or whatever. And I was reading it as, you know, a reader now, and I'm like, is he describing a laser? That's kind of what it was.
That's kind of what we would think of it now, right?
Yeah. But he calls it the heat ray. And that's when things start to get bananas.
Right, like his science friend, who was one of the people who brought him there, is killed.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And a bunch of stuff on Horsel Common gets just burned.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even some houses nearby, like some town nearby, where things start getting
on fire. Things just start getting caught on fire. He notes that when it hits water, the water steams and boils. People are getting killed. And then people start to scatter.
Well, so, yeah, I think that's when he decides to bring his wife to another town to stay with his cousins.
Right. So he runs home.
He borrows a horse and cart from an innkeeper.
The innkeeper.
Right? And then has a hard time convincing it because people are starting to leave.
Yeah. He pays him. He gives him extra money.
Right.
So he gets this like horse and buggy kind of situation. Gets his wife.
What did he call it?
It's a dog cart. Cart. Yeah.
What is a dog cart, do you know?
It's like a small... I think pretty sure it's like a smaller horse and buggy. Mm-hmm. It's like... Because an actual like full buggy is like a big contraption with like multiple wheels.
All right. This is like two wheels.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. It's got two wheels. So he brings her... He brings his wife and this and their servant from the house to a neighboring
cousins,
town.
Like
to the cousins.
Leatherneck or something.
Yeah, Leatherneck, I think it is. And then... But that time it's like nightfall and starting to rain.
Right. Is it like a thunderstorm?
Right. And he
promised to bring the cart. You know, he borrowed the horse and cart. He was going to bring it back and then walk back.
Right.
It was just a couple, I don't know, 10 miles or whatever.
Yeah, he was just really concerned about getting his wife out. You know, he didn't necessarily want to leave the house alone or anything like that. So he goes back to bring back the buggy and he crashes, I forget.
Well, because he's in a thunderstorm.
Right.
And the horses get spooked and he starts seeing the tripods.
Right. And the horse gets spooked and that's how... So this is my favorite scene, which is the first time he describes seeing the Martians in their tripod machine. So there's a few different machines throughout
the story. Right. So you can imagine the scene. It's like it's at night, right? There's a thunderstorm with lightning going off.
Right.
And in the flashes of lightning, all of a sudden he sees this huge...
giant
thing walking past.
Yeah, so it's like a big... It's sort of hard to visualize, but it's sort of like this big metal body, and there's like a sort of like a head portion.
There's lots of illustrations on the internet, including some from the original book.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's kind of like a disc on three legs and kind of walking. Yeah,
and so, but it's huge, and it's like walking right next to him in the field. And so his horse spooks, and they crash, and... The horse. This is the first of many horses that die in this story. And
I think he hides in a...
He's like in a puddle or something.
Yeah,
he like stays down. I think he ends up walking through the forest to go back home at that point. But I just love the imagery of the rain and the thunder and lightning and everything with the giant tripod walking by.
Right. Also, the tripods were carrying like a little thin case underneath the disc on the top, there were three legs, and underneath what looked like was carrying something. The thing that was carrying was the heat ray machine.
Right, yeah.
So it would kind of point it at things and go, psst.
Yeah. So that's the first weapon we see from the Martians, but not the last. So he walks back to the forest and goes back to his house.
Yeah, and he sees the innkeeper dead, right, along the way. And I think he still almost steps on him or something, and
he sees him and like checks to see if he's alive or whatever, and then he's kind of grossed out because he touched a dead body.
Right.
And
then he meets the artillery man.
Artillery man.
In his house. Thank you.
So narrator. Oh, there's a great scene I think that happens there, which is when he looks out the window.
Right.
So the other thing happening at this point is that the military is starting to respond.
Right.
To the Martians. They're not having much success.
No.
But they have responded. So there's like gunfire that he hears, and there's more Martians sort of coming up in these tripods, and there's more heat rays, and like a lot of things are on fire. People are being evacuated from his home, his hometown. And he goes...
Well, by the time he's there at night, you know, the night he saw the tripod, the town's pretty much emptied out.
Yeah. So he goes back home... goes upstairs and looks out the window, and there's another great, like visually a great scene of him like in this dark house looking out the window and sort of describing like the fiery landscape that he sees, and all the trees are alight and all the fields are like barren, and just hearing the sort of the sounds of what sounds like war, like sort of in the distance, but like close enough for him to see it. And that's when the artillery man, the soldier,
right, stops by.
Call him a soldier.
And actually, he gives him a little bit of advice before they leave, saying, make sure you bring some provisions with you.
Yeah.
So he loads up his pockets with some food and stuff.
Right. And now it starts, like, he wanders all over the place. He goes so many places.
So he wants to go back to meet his wife, as he was planning.
Right.
But then he winds up, there's this whole scene at the river.
I just don't remember the order of things. I know that...
Right. So I think he had to, like, crossed the river and there was a ferry or something. And mm-hmm. he gets there and there's like huge crowds of people.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I guess that would be like the next morning.
Yeah. Well, that, and this is when he's also describing how like all the trains are packed and...
Right. There's some train that was destroyed.
Right. That's part of what he sees out the window is the train that's on fire. So, I just don't... Where does he go next with the soldier? I just forget.
No, so they kind of walk towards the ferry, and the soldier goes with some soldiers, and...
Right, they separate.
And he goes to the ferry, and there's, like, a whole big scene at the river where there's a crowd of people trying to get across, and, mm-hmm. and you know, there's some small boats, little boats, and I think two Martians show up, and these tripod...
Oh, right, and they start... This is when they start boiling the water.
Right, so right. They start killing some people, boils the water, and he, at one point, dives under to mm-hmm. try to... save himself.
Yeah, so part of this is that this heat ray situation is a big problem because nothing is stopping this heat ray. It seems it goes through everything. So it's sort of like once it hits you, that's kind of it. So they're coming, you know, towards him across the water, and he dives under, I think sort of trying to maybe make a shield between himself right. and also to yeah. hide.
Right.
And so lots of people start jumping off the boats into the river to hide. From the Martians. And then I think, is this when they hit
yeah, so there was like artillery and some big guns nearby, and mm-hmm. they actually get a salvo off and knock one of the tripods over.
Right, and it actually kills the Martian.
It kills it, but then the other ones take care of the guns right away.
So. Yeah. So, and that, it seems like by the end of the story, that's the one Martian they killed. They don't kill
him. No, there's another one when the ship attacks.
I don't think that those ones actually die, because he... makes a comment later that they only ever actually killed one. But I'm not sure if they just didn't know about, because that's like the brother's story, but we'll get there.
Right.
But yeah, so they kill the one, everyone's happy, and then the other two that are there, like, carry the other one's body away. Everyone's sort of able to narrowly escape
right.
the river. And he gets burned and stuff.
Right, by the hot water.
Yeah. And then he ends up in a boat.
He ends up in a boat, and then... So then there's a whole big description of this... people trying to escape away from these things, and what happens when you have lots of these refugees, people who just load up whatever they can into whatever mm-hmm. thing they can and start going. And he winds up going on some side roads, and he meets these two women in another buggy.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Oh, and, with the revolver?
Yeah, so they were being accosted by some ruffians.
Yeah. Oh, wait, no, is it him or is it his brother who does that?
That's him.
Isn't his brother who beats up the...
Oh.
It's the... Because the brother's a boxer.
You're right.
Yeah.
No, you're right.
So, because what happens is after the river, main narrator...
Kind of says, and then my brother told
right,
me what
exactly.
happened in London.
Main narrator's chilling in a boat, and that's when he meets the curate.
Right, that's right.
Right. Okay, so part of the problem with this is that nobody has any names, so it's a little bit hard to keep track of. So main narrator... is chilling in a boat, because I remember, because he doesn't have a shirt, and he's got, like, burns and stuff.
Right.
And he meets this man that he refers to as the curate, who's, like, I guess a member of the church to some extent. They travel a little bit together, but then the narrator sort of stops his story to describe the story he would hear later from his brother about what happened in London.
Right.
Basically at the same time.
Right.
So it's still, like, structure-wise, it's still the main narrator speaking, but talking about his brother, who also has no name. So the brother's in London. The brother's like a medical student. He's in London when this is happening. And part of the thing was the path of the Martian sort of heads towards London.
Right. Well, in the beginning, he also describes how they had no information or very little information because they're trying to get the papers. And the papers, some of them thought it was a hoax or, you know, or they have very kind of strange descriptions.
Right.
And they had problems with telegraph.
Exactly. So that was their main way to communicate was telegraph, but the destruction happened so quickly
right.
at ground zero, where the Martians land. There's not a lot of information that gets out.
And throughout this time, there's also like additional cylinders falling. So
right. Like one falls every day or so.
Right.
There's 10, I think, total. So the brother's in London, so he sort of doesn't get the brunt of the disaster until a few days later.
Well, so what happens is all of a sudden they realize what's going on, and like maybe Sunday evening,
yeah.
they decide that people need to evacuate.
Mm-hmm. And that's when all these shenanigans
start. Right. So he tries to go to the train station, like he goes to Waterloo Station, which is a place I've visited, and it's just impossible. The trains aren't either not running or it's just impossible to get on it and or even buy a ticket because people want like a lot of money for it and stuff. So he winds up, is he walking? Or is he maybe he's got a cart with a horse or something?
Or a bike. He gets a bike at some point.
Maybe a bike.
Yeah, there's so many different means of transportation throughout this. No cars, though.
Right. They do mention cars, but I mean,
but none of our main characters use cars, yeah.
They just talk about the escape from London, how people are getting away. So now the Martians actually get to London and they used another weapon, which he describes, which is called the black smoke.
Right. And what's interesting about the black smoke is in terms of the structure of the story, we hear first about the black smoke through the brother's story told to us through the narrator. And then we get later the narrator's experience of the black smoke for the first time. So it's just very strange, kind of backwards. So yeah, so the brother's trying to escape London, and the black smoke is basically like a chemical weapon.
Right, like a poison gas, which, as far as I know, was never used as a weapon anywhere yet at that time in history.
Right.
It was something that happened in World War I, as far as I know.
He was ahead of his time. So the poison gas basically poisons the air, and obviously if you breathe it, you die, but it also goes into the water.
Right, but it's like after a while it just settles and leaves like a black
like a
film on the scum on the ground. But
there's an interesting description of how it interacts with water. It like goes into water and then sinks through.
Right.
So that the water that's clear is still safe to drink, which I thought was interesting. So the brother's trying to escape London, right? And he's on a road and he comes across these ladies who are being accosted by ruffians.
Right. And he kind of ruffians, since he's the boxer, he has a fight with some of them.
Yeah.
He knocks some of them out, and one of the ladies actually brought a revolver, so she shoots up in the air, and the guys kind of give up and run away. So he joins them, and trying to go somewhere. At one point, they're like on some side roads or something, and they come to a main road, and it's just impossible to cross, because there's like a river of people escaping, and there's some interesting descriptions of like this. So some guy who drops his money and it spills all over the place. He tries to pick it up. He gets run over and smooshed into the mud.
There's a little girl who gets separated from her mom.
Right.
It's just chaotic. And this is one of the times where like the writing really shines. And just imagining like how chaotic the scene is. And they can't get their horse and cart through. And they have to turn around. So, and the two ladies he's traveling with are like a mother and a...
And daughter or something.
Yeah, or like a wife and a sister or something. Like, he has some kind of weird description of them. The one lady is like really on top of her game and like really like capable of doing a lot of stuff. And the other one's like sort of going crazy and like just wants to go home. And she keeps talking about how if they just go back, that they'll be fine, all these things. But, you know, she can't go home because her home was attacked. And they end up ultimately going to the shore, getting on a boat.
Right. So the other interesting thing while they're trying to escape is basically the old society falls apart.
Right.
So things like, you know, having food, for example, and they wind up not having any food or people just simply break into houses or whatever and steal what they can. I'm not sure what happened to the ladies, right? So they got to the shore and they actually got passage onto a steamer.
Right.
Had to pay some extra...
Yeah. You
know, £10, which was a lot of money at the time. The steamer starts pulling away, either going up further north in England or maybe go to France or something. And while that's happening, the Martians are actually at the shore as well. And he describes this fight between, what was this ship called? Something Thunder?
Thunderbolt?
No.
Thunderchild?
Thunderchild.
Thunderchild, yeah.
So there's like a warship that basically rams one of the Martians.
Right, it rams more than one, right? It rams one and then it rams another one.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I think it might take down two. So, but it's sort of an interesting description because basically the Martians, you know, in their tripods are really tall and they can wade out into the water. But as they wade into the water, they get shorter and shorter, right? Because their legs go deeper and deeper. So at some point, their bodies are level with the ships.
Right.
So the Thunder Child is able to ram them and the end is destroyed in the process. So
I didn't thought thing was very clear. I mean, they did It showed black smoke at it, but I don't know if it was...
No, I think it was destroyed in the process, because I think he says there, and there was nothing of the Thunder Child left. Okay. Maybe it wasn't. I don't know. I would like it if it wasn't, but...
I guess one of the things he was trying to show is that as is typical now of these kinds of stories, is that the weapons that humans have are not effective against alien weapons.
Right, exactly. And that was the thing. It's like that we were just getting steamrolled by the Martians. You know, there was like nothing that could be done, and more Martians were coming. So that's where the brother's story ends.
Yeah, I think it ends when he's
on a boat.
Sailing away on the boat, yeah.
Yeah, he got out of there. So, meanwhile, our narrator is... They're like maybe like a week or so into this now.
Right, and they go into some house trying to hide.
Right, so he's with this man who he calls the curate, and he starts to note pretty early on that he and the curate really don't get along very well.
Yeah, the man is losing it a bit.
Yeah. And there's like, you know, our narrator's not really about this guy. But this guy just kind of keeps following
him. He's kind of following him, kind of whiny.
Yeah. Yeah, they go into a house. They just pick a house and go inside to look for food and stuff. It so happens, while they're there, that yet another meteor falls. And it falls, like, right
almost
next
on the
to the house.
House.
Yeah.
Right next to a house.
Like, half the house comes down. And so they're trapped in this house. Partially because of, like, physically being blocked in. Though there are exits, ultimately. But mostly because now there's another...
the pit
cylinder.
With the Martians, yeah,
right. There's another pit.
Right out, and they find like in the kitchen or somewhere there's like a little slit they can actually observe what's going on.
Right, so they get to watch.
So then find out what the Martians want humans for.
Right. So surprise, surprise! The Martians eat people.
Well, they drink blood.
They drink blood. Well, but then everything's always described as being like the bones being picked clean, so they've got to eat the rest of it.
Well, it's possible that other things eat the meat, like dogs or whatever.
I guess.
Or animals.
Yeah, so at some point in time, towards the end, the narrator stops and describes the Martians' bodies. And one of the things he talks about is that they don't have a digestive system like we do. That they like just directly, more or less, inject the blood of other animals into their veins.
Right.
It's like much more...
Efficient
way. Instead of like eating and digesting, they just sort of inject it in.
And he describes them as these kind of large heads, kind of a thing, big brain, mm-hmm. kind of a thing. With
yeah.
They had eyes.
They have eyes. They have
tentacles
like by their mouth or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like they have 8 tentacles, 4 on each side, and they have like this flat thing on the back of their head that turns out
like
to be
an eardrum or something. Yeah.
And they're like kind of brown and wishy looking. So, and it turns out like they find out later they can't see like violet and blue or something, like some colors that they don't right. see or whatever.
Also, he speculates that they communicate via psychic ESP or something.
Right, because they make some noises, and we'll talk about this in a little bit in terms of how this is similar or dissimilar to some of the other aliens we've seen. But they make some noises, but they're so organized in what they do, and they don't like speak often enough for at least his interpretation of it, like for that to be enough. Like he thinks there must be something additional. So they hide out in this house.
So what happens was when they get there and get trapped, they find some food, and then he tries to organize it, saying, you know, we eat this little bit every day, so mm-hmm. it lasts at least 10 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the curate's not about that life.
The curate is just losing it. He's
yeah.
getting crazier and crazier. Mm-hmm. He wants to eat this food. He cries. He whimpers.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants him to be quiet because he's afraid the Martians will right outside will hear.
Exactly. And ultimately, the curate does start making too much noise and starts saying, like, I'm going to end it. I'm just going to go out there and, like, end it now. And our narrator hits him on the back of the head with, like, the butt of a
cleaver or something.
Cleaver, yeah. But then it knocks him out.
Right.
But the noise does attract the Martians at that point.
Right.
So our narrator runs and hides, but the tentacles, the Martian tentacles, come in the house and find the curate and take him and eat him.
Right, for a snack. And he has to hide in a coal cellar.
Yeah. So he goes into the coal tunnel and, like, piles coal around him. And there's a great scene where he's hiding in there, in the coal on the wood. And he can see, he hears
because it's dark.
Right, he hears, like, the tentacles going through the house and, like, searching. And then the tentacles come to the door to the coal cellar. And then they pull the latch and they open the door. And there's a great line where he's like, Martians know how doors work. I'm like, yeah, they do. And the Martian ultimately takes a piece of coal and doesn't take anything else. So it doesn't find him, so he survives. Waits a few more days.
Right, he waits a few more days and all of a sudden things get quiet. So mm-hmm. he starts noticing this red weed.
Yeah. So things get quiet and ultimately the Martians...
Well, I mean, he goes out and the Martians are gone from that pit. So.
From that particular pit, right. And so it's safe for him to sort of be out. And he was in the house for like 2 weeks or like a long time.
Yeah.
Like 15 days, I think.
Yeah.
And there's this red plant.
Yeah, so when he steps up, he's all of a sudden, you know, the fields that used to be green, they're all covered in this red weed. So he wanted to find out what happened in London, so he starts kind of making his way towards London.
Mm-hmm. But what's the red weed? Like, what is it?
So, I mean, it looks like it's like a plant that was brought by the Martians,
mm-hmm.
right? And it just started spreading like wild, and he said it's much more prominent near water. So whenever there was water, it would grow quite a bit.
Right, it was like he tries to eat it at one point. He says it's like watery and it has like a metallic kind of taste. Mm-hmm. Ew. So yeah, so he in the same paragraph where he describes the plant and how it spread everywhere, he also described how it all suddenly sort of died.
There are places and it starts dying, right?
Right.
Because it was exposed to bacteria on mm-hmm. Earth, and then he kind of gets it's kind of a
foreshadowing,
hint.
Yeah. It's a wee bit of foreshadowing there, and he talks a little bit about how it, you know, it's not designed to live on Earth and it couldn't deal with the bacteria that all the earth foliage can deal with, that kind of thing.
And he's been also like foraging for food and hardly anything to eat. He managed to find some roots and
finds like mushrooms and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Drinks a lot of really dirty water in a lot of places. Yeah, so he...
So then he runs into the soldier.
Right, so him and the soldier meet up again.
Right.
And the soldier is not so okay. He's like...
Well, the soldier is planning to survive.
Yeah.
So, you know, he... At first, when they first meet, they don't recognize each other. Mm-hmm. So the soldier kind of tells him to get off my land, essentially. This is mine.
Yeah.
And get away from here. But then they recognize each other, so they spend some time together. And the soldier kind of has this new theory of how human race can survive underground.
Mm-hmm. Right. And this is sort of when he starts to talk about that we are to the Martians as like ants are to us. And so the best way for humans to survive is to like go live underground, not be a nuisance to the Martians, just become like a mildly annoying like vermin kind of situation.
Right.
And, you know, learn. Ultimately, his idea is that a human could learn how to operate one of these machines, one of these tripod machines.
Right.
And
fight the Martians.
Could fight them back, exactly. And he has some interesting ideas about how the Martians will take humans as pets and have humans hunt other humans and have human farms and things like that.
And then, you know, he starts digging because he thinks he can dig under the house that they're staying in and connect to, like, the sewers that go into London. So this way he can be, you know, live in the sewers.
Right. And he's got, like, a shovel and like, he's going at it. He's digging that tunnel.
Well, he's got the narrator to do the same.
Yeah. You know? So at first, our narrator's like all for this, and he thinks this is great, and you know this guy's going to survive. We don't have to just give up, whatever. And then the narrator sort of starts to think about it a little bit more critically, and starts to think like.
And the guy is like a little bit crazy.
Yeah, the narrator realizes that like the tunnel he's dug is like not really that deep, and the guy's been working on this apparently for like weeks, and he's like not really made any progress, and it doesn't make any sense to dig this tunnel. Why don't you just go enter the sewer from like a manhole, like a sewer entrance, and sort of starts to pick apart this
plan.
This plan, yeah, and gets a pretty quickly disillusioned of it.
So then I think he leaves him and he decides to go to London.
Yeah, I think the narrator says he feels like he betrayed like his wife and stuff, and like basically stopping trying to go find her.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So he heads off to London at that point.
So when he gets there, he talks about what it looks like, you know, the parts that were covered by the black smoke, mm-hmm. and he sees dead bodies of horses and people still around.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, at one point, he starts hearing this strange sound.
Yeah, the ululu.
Ululu.
Yeah. It's like he calls it a ululation, I guess. And it's like this constant chronic sound that's going on through the whole. And it's this sort of very interesting, you know, post-apocalyptic kind of landscape.
Right.
Where like all the buildings are crumbling. There's bodies everywhere and skeletons and no living people. He doesn't see any of the living people in London. And the sound is going and going. And finally, at one point when he's in London, and I think he sees some Martians from a distance.
Maybe,
in various places. At one point, the sound suddenly stops. And at first, when he had first heard the sound, it bothered him. But then the fact that the sound stops after having gone for so long bothers him more. And he,
I think he finds the place where he was trying to walk towards, trying to find where the sound was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and he gets to a place where there's a couple of these tripods just kind of dead.
Yeah. And so he has this moment where he just kind of throws all caution to the wind and says, I'm just going to end it, and, you know, this is going to be it. And he goes up to the tripods and finds that they're being feasted on by crows. And he sees, like, the... because there's a Martian inside each tripod.
Right.
And he sees, like, the gooey Martian, like, hanging out of the tripod and the crows, like, picking at it. And starts to walk around and realize all the tripods are dead.
Right. And what killed them?
Well, wouldn't you know it, they don't have bacteria on Mars. So that's what happens when the Martians are exposed to the bacteria on Earth. They get infected, basically. And so it took a few weeks for them to die, but they ultimately die from the exposure.
Right.
Which is not unrealistic.
Right.
You know, it's one of the... I mean, that even happens, you know, that happens with people with... you know, colonization on Earth, and historically one of the problems was that you'd bring new diseases to people who didn't have the immune system for it.
Right.
So all the Martians die from the bacteria. So then there's like a chapter or two of reconstruction.
Right. Well, if you're wondering what happened to his wife, he goes back to his house, mm-hmm. and while he's there, his wife arrives. So so there's a happy ending.
Yeah.
And clearly his brother was okay because, you know,
he's
he told the story.
In the motor. Yeah. So yeah, he's reunited with his wife. They're able to start rebuilding. There's sort of speculation by the characters as to, you know, what are the chances that the Martians will invade again. There's some speculation that the Martians are landing on Venus.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
They think they see some activity that indicates the Martians are maybe colonizing Venus. You know, whether or not they would be prepared for another Martian invasion, that kind of thing. But yeah, I guess technically it's a happy ending, yeah.
Right.
And I think part of it, too, I guess maybe one of the themes that comes out of the way the book ends, sort of thinking about, like, the balance of power and the sort of, like the balance of power in the animal kingdom kind of thing, is that humans evolved to live on Earth and so evolved to be immune to these bacteria and the Martians didn't. And so they were all, like, no matter what kind of technology they had, they would always be at a disadvantage.
Right.
Which is interesting. Okay, so we covered the plot. We hit a bunch of the different stuff that we want to talk about. So let's talk about a few things. In terms of science fiction ideas, there's this whole section where he talks about how the Martians don't have wheels, and their technology doesn't seem to have...
Right, like, didn't invent wheels, which is kind of weird. But it happened among human civilizations, like the Aztecs did not have wheels.
Oh, really?
I mean, they had toys that had wheels, but not as a means of transportation. And somebody posited that, like, the Aztecs, let's say, lived in the mountains. There was not too many flat areas.
Mm.
So wheel is not that useful.
Oh, yeah, and he describes their technology also as being sort of like just built very differently than how, like, a human would build it. Like, the way that the pieces of the tripod fit together and stuff.
Right.
I had to do more with, like, friction than
he also
pieces.
Talked about the machine that they used to build other stuff.
Yeah.
Right, like he was observing them from the house. I imagine this like a crab-like machine that was walking around and making stuff,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it was really neat. So there was some, and like, then of course, like we were saying before, we have some of these classic science fiction ideas that pop up first here, like the heat ray, which obviously took off in science fiction.
Right.
And the chemical, the black smoke,
right,
which took off in real life. So
nice.
in not so good a way. In terms of science fiction that maybe didn't work, you were talking about the space travel.
The space travel, so now we know so much more about space travel. At the time, the idea was that you would make a really big gun and you shoot people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Jules Verne wrote when he wrote about Trip to the Moon. And this is, they seem to, it wasn't entirely clear, but that's what they implied.
Right.
But I mean, that's because that's the only technology I could think of back then.
Right, and that was just for when the Martians were coming to Earth, right? Because they were, like, observing Mars.
Right. The idea of psychic aliens, I don't like that. You know, but again, this is just something posited. That doesn't mean, you know, at the time, mm-hmm. I don't know if radio was even a technology yet.
Mm-hmm.
So if the aliens had radio to communicate with each other, you know, it would seem miraculous.
Right, exactly.
Or the other thing that I always like to think about is, like, what if they communicated by sound, but they used a sound range that was out of human hearing.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, I like that because that's sort of like our narrator is sort of unreliable in the sense that our author is sort of unreliable because the author, you know, imagined a lot of things and maybe couldn't have even imagined something like the radio, that kind of stuff. But yeah, I don't think them being psychic is necessary.
Yeah,
to the
I mean,
story
right,
or,
right. I mean, he just
yeah.
The what was interesting is that because this was 19th century, you know, it's like how, you know, what the life, like regular life was like back then, mm-hmm. all of a sudden gets disrupted by this crazy thing. But the fact that everybody waited for papers to come out to get news. You know,
yeah.
There was no radio, no TV. That's how you got news.
Mm-hmm.
And papers were published many times a day.
Yeah.
All communications between cities was via telegraph. And to travel was, well, you took a train.
Yeah.
Or you went by horse and buggy. So there were some interesting limitations there.
Well, that sort of begs the question, you know, how different would this story be if it happened now, like in 2018?
Right. So, you know. Well, you can find out because clearly this story was made into several movies throughout since it's been published.
Yeah.
So that there's Orson Welles, the radio show, there's actual movie that was made maybe in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a movie that was with Tom Cruise that was made maybe 10 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Which one?
It's called The War of the Worlds.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And so maybe we should put that on our list as well. It was pretty bad.
Yeah.
And, you know, the aliens come to Bayonne. But this kind of answers the question. It's very similar structure. It's like, you know, where they, you know, try to escape. And mm-hmm. there's like the scene at the ferry almost is almost exactly replayed in
oh,
that
really?
Movie. And they get stuck in some house mm-hmm. and, you know, this kind of stuff.
It's very, you haven't watched the show The Walking Dead or read mm-hmm. the comics, but it's very, this sort of post-apocalyptic, you know, sudden giant traumatic thing that happens, reactionary kind of stories have a lot of that stuff in common. This, like, when I was right. reading this, it read very much like The Walking Dead. Where,
yeah,
like,
I'm wondering, though, if he was the first one to do that. Or whether there were other stories kind of like that. I bet you there's lots of stories from war.
Yeah. It must be because I imagine it'd be the same thing if you're living in your nice little peaceful town and your neighbor just suddenly invades you.
Right. You know, until World War I, the wars weren't quite as total. You know. So.
Right, but I mean, it doesn't. If you only live in a small section of the world, you know, until rather recently, people didn't travel that far. Right. They were born
right.
and lived and died sort of in the same area, just because traveling was so difficult. You know, if it doesn't need to be so total if the clan next to you invaded your clan's planes or whatever,
sure. yeah.
then that was it. That was everything to you. So I think that sort of plays into some of the many themes of this story. I love literary themes.
Okay.
But, I mean, I think huge here is, like, the whole concept, broadly, the theme of war is hell. Like, war is bad. That's a, you know, pretty basic, very broad theme
right.
that definitely is played out here.
Right. It's I was kind of before reading this book again, I had assumed that it was written after World War One.
Oh, interesting.
And I was totally surprised that it wasn't. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's part of the interesting thing is that it did sort of, it has that feel. It does feel like a war story. Mm-hmm. But, which is interesting because, is it a war? Is it really, because it's called War of the Worlds. But it's not really a war so much as, like, a steamroll.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, you know.
There's, I mean, calling it a war is kind of being generous to the human efforts that were
well,
made.
They tried, you know.
They killed, like, maybe, like, max 3 Martians.
And, well, as far as we know, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's sort of interesting with the title is War of the Worlds, and the it's really not a war so much as it is an invasion of Earth.
Right. Along those lines is, I kind of like the story is because it's just told from one person's point of view, essentially, mm-hmm. as opposed to a lot of the present-day science fiction is, like, all galactic.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you find out what the whole galaxy is going to die, you know, because, you know, Luke Skywalker doesn't do something or other. And this is just told, like, what would it look like on a human scale as opposed to this kind of unrealistic galactic scale. Mm-hmm. So we have no idea what's going on, and because he didn't know what was going on.
Exactly. And I think that's part of what, when you read like war stories, that is sort of a classic way to write a war story, because it, you know, part of the danger and the fear associated with being in a war is that you are just one individual.
Right.
And really, you as an individual don't have a lot of power.
Right.
So, you know, even when he's sitting and talking to the soldier, and the soldier's saying, you know, we can survive and we can rebuild, and da da da, it's like part of what our narrator realizes is that's totally futile. Like, that whole idea is this guy's digging a tunnel in the basement of a house somewhere near London. Like, what is he doing? That's, he doesn't really have any power to do anything. I think it's really interesting that this was before World War One. Because one thing I think about the genre is that when you're writing speculative fiction, science fiction or fantasy, it's one of the great things you can do with it is take real world issues and frame them in a fictional way so that your reader can be more critical of them, right? Because it's easier to engage with and be more critical of something that isn't close to you.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's, like, easier to, like, you tackle racism through Star Trek by having, you know, all Klingons and Vulcans don't like each other. Well, we as humans can look at two fictional species and say, two fictional races and say, oh, well, racism is bad, obviously. They shouldn't be racist towards each other.
Right.
It's easier for an audience to engage with that than if you were to put, like, real racial issues on screen. So it's sort of interesting because this story puts real, like, war and invasion issues and sort of turns it on its head, because not only are the aliens invading Earth and, like, winning straight up, but they're invading England, and England invaded everywhere else in the globe.
Right, that's true.
And it sort of puts the English in the situation in the position of the people that have been colonized by England.
Right.
So it's sort of like turning, it's like playing with that
interesting
dichotomy.
Interesting, I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of neat. I don't know if that was his point or just because he lived in England, that's where he said it, you know?
Yeah. The thing is, this is probably more of a topic for the next show, but the fact that we kind of ascribe human motives to aliens, mm-hmm. right? Why would they care about invading Earth? You know, we are, as humans, into invading other countries and this, mm-hmm. but, you know, why? Mm-hmm. You know, so he... There's some speculation about what it might be, but...
Right, and so, I mean, like, in the story, do we have any indication that the Martians came to extinguish humans, or were they just reacting to the fact that humans started attacking them? Well, I guess technically the Martians attacked first with the heat,
yeah,
right?
the Martians came to Earth, right? So there was no humans going to Mars. So, and the potential... They seem to hint that they went to Venus as well.
Yeah.
But maybe they needed to resettle, I don't know.
Yeah. And one thing I was wondering was the Martians seem to sort of beeline for London, like wherever, because I've never been to England, so I don't know where.
Well, they landed like in the suburbs and they wanted to go towards where there's lots of food.
Oh, I see that. That would be a reason. Because I was wondering, like, did they know that was the capital? Did, like, was there like some because he opens the book saying that, you know, they didn't know they were being watched.
Right.
And I guess they still don't know if they were being watched. There's no indication that the Martians knew anything in particular about them.
That they could eat them.
Right, just that they would be delicious, right. I think then the other sort of big theme that appears throughout and is very interestingly handled is just the way that people deal with traumatic experiences and the ways that big traumatic things happen while being juxtaposed with like regular everyday life, right? Like I think I was mentioning before we started recording the one of the first days after the first shell lands in the story, our main character wakes up the next morning and like his neighbor's like gardening and gives him some strawberries.
Right.
Right. And then our character like eats the strawberries and goes to check out the cool alien shell that landed in the field. And throughout the story, there are these moments where he stops and reads the paper at some point, like after the destruction has really started. And it's this very normal activity in this very abnormal setting.
Right.
I think it's fascinating because that's, I guess when you think about big, horrible events, you think like...
Well, that's what happens in war. One day you just kind of eating strawberries from your garden. The next day you're trying to, you know, not to get run over by things on the road, trying to escape from...
Right, from someone, exactly. Yeah. So I thought that was very well done. That added a lot to the tone, I guess, of the whole thing. Do you want to talk about their reaction to the flying machines?
But they didn't have flying machines yet. They just said that Martians appeared to have to work on solving the secret of flight.
Right. So the Martians were trying to make a flying machine, and this was before we had flying machines.
We had balloons.
Well, before we had planes. And that I just think it's interesting because like. I mean, I guess maybe I'll go watch the Tom Cruise movie, but, you know, thinking about the story nowadays, like, what technology could the Martians have that would seem, like, so amazing to us?
But the thing is, a lot of the part of this, the story of this book is that how the social fabric just breaks up.
Yeah.
And you don't realize how much you depend on just, like, you know, so we have internet, that's fine, but what the electricity... goes away, all of a sudden there's no internet anymore.
Right, exactly.
You know, we have cell phones that can take pictures, but the cell phone towers go away, you can't call anybody,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's there's lots of infrastructure that kind of underlies civilization
mm-hmm.
that can be easily, you know, ripped apart.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of what happens in Tom Cruise's movie.
Mm-hmm.
But the same thing here, like trains become useless because... You know,
well, the tracks get destroyed.
Tracks get destroyed, or people aren't, you know, too many people try to get on,
mm-hmm.
and telegraph lines are broken, so you can't have any communication.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's why, like you were saying, that this is sort of just like the one point of view, like the one person's experience.
Right.
That, in order to tell this story, I think you need that, because if you do like a broader kind of thing, you don't have that sense of helplessness and urgency
right.
and stuff. And you're, if you have like too many characters or something that's too broad and galactic, right? It's
well, like a movie like 4th of July, you know,
mm-hmm.
with another alien invasion with these big yeah. ships come out. Everybody knows where they are. Yada yada mm-hmm. yada. There's communications all throughout.
Right,
you know?
Right. I mean, I think those are the big major themes and stuff. What about? Well, I said my favorite scene already is that scene in the beginning when he sees mm-hmm. the tripod in the thunderstorm.
Yeah, I always liked the discovery, like when they first land and people wonder what the hell is this, and then. They come out and start shooting people. So,
yeah.
so in all the like various monster movies, I always like the part from the beginning to when the monster appears,
mm-hmm.
and then after that, it's just the same.
Yeah. Least favorite stuff about the book. I mean, I think generally it was very good. I liked a lot of it. I think that, and this might just be me as a modern reader, there's too much description of specifically where he's like walking, and I know that. That's just like a style thing over time. Like if you look at 19th century writing, 20th century writing, 21st century
I almost
writing.
Was tempted to like go on a map and try to draw a line.
Draw it out. Because it really, like, there's a really detailed description of like, you know, I left
such and such,
such place and went right and went down this road. And it's like, it just takes up a lot of words in the story that, I mean, as a modern reader, I didn't need. But I know that like, you know, you go back and read things like, things like Victor Hugo wrote and stuff, and like they spend huge amounts of time describing the places, and I guess it's because you can't, like, Google it and see what it looks like.
Right.
Now it's like, you know, if you're going to read Hunchback of Notre Dame, you could skip the whole first chapter. He just describes Paris, like, street by street. Just, like, watch the Disney movie, and you get, like, the
image. I don't think the Disney movie gives you a good idea of what Paris is like.
But... it's good enough for you to read the rest of the book. So, what was your least favorite? I had difficulty with that, and I also had difficulty. The whole story of the curate was sort of interesting, and I don't know if I'm thinking too hard about it or trying to make excuses for it or whatever, but I didn't really get the whole curate plot line, because ultimately our main character commits murder, right? He knocks him out and then he gets eaten. But the main character, main narrator, specifically says that he, while he killed the curate, he does not feel bad about it. Which I was kind of like, well, that's weird. But then at the same time, the narrator can't stop thinking about the fact that the curate was killed and eaten. So at first I was like, you know, if this murder did nothing for the characterization, why did we bother having it? It was kind of a waste. I was a little bit confused. But then I was thinking about it harder, and I was like,
it's a preview of PTSD, you know. So he says, I did what I had to do, you know, ta-da. But then later on it's going to come back on him.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe it's deeper than I gave it credit for.
No, the curate and the soldier, I guess now they would be like almost typical characters in any kind of post-apocalyptic story. Like, the curate was this needy guy who just couldn't take it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the soldier was like a survivalist, you know, do anything to survive, you know.
Yeah, they sort of counterbalance each other.
Yeah.
In that way. Did you have any least favorite portions?
I don't know, probably the same as you. Some descriptions kind of dragged on a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And he names all these towns, and it's like somebody who lived around that time probably would know. But it's like he drops these names, and I have actually recognized a couple of them because I've been to London a few times. So like when he was walking around London in naming streets, there's some famous streets that I've been on.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the towns he mentions actually were like stops on the train when you go to and from the airport or something. So
the airport with flying machines?
Right, flying machines, crazy.
Do you think it, I mean, we've sort of been talking about this the whole time, do you think it aged well? Do you think the story?
Actually, yeah.
I think so too.
And because it, you know, his description of the technology of the Martians kind of is in the language of that time, and it fits, right? So
yeah, and the technology the Martians have, interestingly enough, is still advanced from what we have, right? Like do we have heat beams, heat rad? If we do, I don't see them normally, so I don't know about them. We certainly don't have them walking on tripods,
right?
Burning forests,
right?
You know, his descriptions are still very alien, which I think is really interesting.
Mm.
So I think it aged well. I'm not surprised. It's been done and redone 100 times. It's a good idea. But I liked it. I thought the writing was fantastic. I did not expect the writing to be that good. So, did you like it?
Yeah.
I think we basically picked apart the story.
I think so.
There's plenty of comparison to be done between, like, the appearance of these aliens and aliens we've seen across the other stories. The ways the humans interact with these aliens and what makes something alive, like that kind of stuff.
Right.
So I think in the next podcast we do, we're going to sit down. So what are the 5 stories we've done? We did...
Left Hand of Darkness.
Right, with Earth by Ursula Le Guin.
Solaris.
Mm-hmm.
The Story of Your Life.
Right.
Piggies.
Speaker for the Dead.
My speaker, right.
Yeah.
And this one.
Yeah, we've had some other aliens that are... It's interesting, like, I guess we could talk about, like, the levels of sentience and stuff like that. And
Yeah. I mean, just the whole notion how to portray an alien thing in the book. And I've read... Since then, I've read some others with some other interesting ideas. So we can save it for then.
Have any final closing thoughts on this our last weird alien book? Did we pick a theme for the next batch of books we're going to do?
I thought we were going to do dystopias.
Oh yes, we're going to do
dystopias. The preview is that H.G. Wells wrote some utopias.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to read some of those before we get into that other stuff.
We can read a utopia amongst reading the dystopias. I mean, how do you know it's a dystopia unless you know what a utopia is?
Mm. All right.
Okay, I think that's it for this episode of History in Reverse. That was us talking about War of the Worlds. Next time, we will be doing a comparison across the five stories that we've read about all the weird aliens, and then we'll be getting into, I guess, starting in 2019, the dystopias.
Right.
And reading through those. So thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you guys next time.
Bye.
Bye. Gosh, it's going to be hard to remember the order of events for this because it does a lot of walking around. Okay. You have your notes?
Yeah.